Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ned Sublett continue the Latin Roll miniseries based on Ned's classic book, Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll, or should I say Latin Roll. That's right, I'm welcoming back Ned Sublett to continue our discussion of Cuba and its music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Ned, welcome back.
Thank you, Nate.
And today we're talking about colonial Cuba. So last time we talked about the Spanish, their Arabic influences, and we also talked about the African influences. And I sort of panicked and brought in the native, the indigenous a bit. So we already talked about the Taino, but technically I should have followed your lead and talked about them now. But anyway, we're going to take this through the 19th century in this episode. So tell us about the arrival of Europeans in Spain. In the New World, Ned.
So we're going to cover three centuries in an hour. This is going to go by quick, y'all. Take note.
Yeah, it is. We trust you.
So the arrival of, what was the question? I'm sorry.
The arrival of the Spanish in the New World and how it gets to Cuba.
The arrival of the Spanish in what came to be called the Americas. Oh, my gosh. Well, let's go back to 1491, baby, when the Congo is Catholicized. The year after that, a lot of big things happen. The Spanish Christians retake Granada. March in, Isabel and Fernando march in dressed in Moorish costume and assert their control over all of Iberia. The Jews are told that they must convert or leave, and an exodus of the people known as Sephardim begins. And of course, the least important at the time, it seemed, that sailor from Genoa, Christopher Columbus, as he's called in English, sets out. And it takes, he makes four voyages, comes to Cuba. It takes a little while for the first city in the New World is the so-called New World. It wasn't new to the people who were already living there. It was Santo Domingo. And Cuba begins to be settled in the 15 teens, populated with villas or cities, a small set of settlements that run from Baracoa in the east across to San Cristobal de La Habana in the west. Havana is an obvious place for a settlement because of its magnificent deep water bay, protected by a long, narrow channel, easily defensible. And indeed, for centuries, the Spanish would put a chain across the channel at night. You can still see where it is if you go to Havana today. It's still a prominent part of Havana's landscape. And Havana becomes the hub of the Spanish empire in the Americas as far as shipping goes. There were no merchants in Havana at first who participated in this. The merchants were in Spain, the merchants were in Peru, the merchants were in Mexico. Havana was the place where the ships unloaded their precious metals as mining developed. The Spanish were interested in mining, not plantations. And the Spanish ripped as much silver and gold out of the bowels of Mexico and Peru as they could dig out, process, and stuff into ships. And those ships stopped in Havana for a substantial amount of time before going back to Spain. What this all has to do with music is, of course, that this network of shipping was created and sailors went back and forth. Not only sailors, other kinds of people as well, but especially sailors traveling back and forth, carrying not only precious metal, but songs and dances after having been weeks and weeks in what became an Afro-Latin hemisphere, as Africans were brought in and Black people from Spain as well came. There was a sort of a center of music and dance in this Wild West town of Havana, because, of course, this was where the ships had to lay up before going back to Spain. So sailors would be there for weeks, even months at a time, as over the years, the fleet system developed, which sent large, by the time the fleets were in operation, the fleets from Mexico and the galleons from Cartagena, all of this material that was being loaded into the ships took time. The ships had to be refitted. And so the sailors laid up, did the things sailors do. They hung out, gambled, drank, danced, and they danced a lot, apparently, in the taverns of Havana, because Havana was this melting pot where all the new Afro-Latin jams of the hemisphere came together and creolized, in a sense, before going back to Spain, where they traveled up through Europe and slowly became part of the music of Europe. The most famously, the Sarabanda, which travels in the late 16th century to Spain, travels up through Europe, and a century and a half later finds itself in the work of J.S. Bach, Sarabanda, named for the Congo god of iron and war, and it's followed by the Chacona or Pasacalle, something that passes through the street, all of which is to say that Havana became very quickly the capital of music and dance in the Americas.
Yeah, I love the comparison you make with Cadiz, which you had called the tavern at the end of the world in the ancient world when it was way out on the west coast of Spain. And now Havana has taken over that role. And you also you mentioned the Congolese source of the word Zarabanda, but Western scholars have frequently been baffled by the source of that name because they don't think to look back to Africa. So I'm glad you solved that puzzle for us. I'm going to play our first song, and when we come back, we're going to have to backtrack because I forgot to bring drums into the story. But first, we'll hear the Zarabanda as played by Gaspar Sanz. This is composed by Gaspar Sanz from 1640 to 1710. This is performed by Andreas Nachtsheim on Baroque guitar and Klaus Mader on Colascione. This is the Zarabanda by Gaspar Sanz. Ned, so my fault. I should have asked you about drums before we got to the New World, because this is something you discussed. What was the European relationship to drums, and who really reintroduced them to drums? Because presumably they had drums before the Catholic Church came along, all church music was a cappella, didn't play instruments, and it was war from the East that introduces the Europeans to drums again.
There are different accounts of this, depending on what period of history you're looking at. I make a big argument in Cuban It's Music that and echoing Fernando Ortiz's similar argument, it's not entirely original on my part, that the Turkish armies are generally credited with bringing percussion forces into the European orchestra, into the cymbals of the Janissaries, for example, as well as the trumpets and drums that they used in their military campaigns. But as Fernando Ortiz says, before that, there were the Almoravids, who back in the day conquered Spain from a base in sub-Saharan Africa. Right. These were African Muslims who conquered Spain or what at the time was called Al-Andalus, conquered Muslim Iberia at a time when the Umayyad dynasty and the Abbasid, the Umayyad dynasty in Cordoba had weakened Al-Andalus had degenerated into a set of city-states of taifas or petty kingdoms, leaving it ripe for takeover. And when the Almoravids came, they came blasting with drums, which is the punchline of all this. Drums from Africa, played by African soldiers, coming up into Spain. So they were there well before the Turks. So you can look at it, both of those are valid. The drums came into Spain and then the Turks transformed the sound of Europe. But I think that those is the two main forces.
Yeah, I want to sort of emphasize another thing, the importance of military bands. In the 21st century, when we get reports, we see video from these horrors that are happening in the Ukraine, it's impossible to imagine how a little marching band has anything to do with war. But several hundred years ago, especially before cannons were common, and even when cannons were a minor ingredient in the battlefield, the sound of drums, snare drums, trumpets, and various horns allowed military units to signal one another over the sound of men screaming and fighting and dying and stabbing each other with swords and shooting each other with muskets. the sound was loud enough of trumpets and snare drums for them to signal military instructions. Also, it was a great way to intimidate your opponents, as, you know, here in Texas, we always learned about Santa Anna terrorizing the, you know, the occupants of the Alamo with, I think, DeGuayo, the death song. And so this was it had a very practical function, and it was something that all the leaders of Europe paid very close attention to. But now I want to talk to you about, go ahead.
That's right. Musicians were an integral part of armies, and as armies became more professionalized, sort of reaching its apogee with Napoleon, the bands also got larger and more elaborate. But from but it was unthinkable to have an army without its musicians, and this has effects that we hear all over the place today. Our jazz instrumentarium basically derives from the military band, of which there were plenty of military band instruments in New Orleans. Or while we don't see marching bands going into battle with soldiers anymore, I was watching just two nights ago the arrival of the Brazilian president Lula in Argentina, and he was greeted on the tarmac by a military band playing an anthem, and they all marched off the plane as the band played. The ceremonial role is still significant.
Indeed. Now I want to ask you about another chapter title that you used, and how dance crazes migrated from Havana back to Europe. You said, "From the Indies, it has come by post," was the chapter title. And you talk about the...
That was Lope de Vega's line about the Chacona. It came by from the Indies by post.
Exactly. Now, tell us about the Chacona and what was African about it, and then how did it transmit around the globe?
Well, the Chacona, or Pasacalle, as I mentioned before, the Pasacalle, is characterized by an ostinato bass. Ostinato, from the Italian word meaning obstinate, meaning it repeats over and over and over. It's a simple repeating bass figure. This is something that we're really, really familiar with in popular music today, but it wasn't the norm in European music at the time. And coming from the Afro-Latin Indies, I argued that there is a sense of African music in this textural concept.
And another thing that was interesting to me that I didn't understand before reading this was that the Europeans would take African rhythms, but then they still didn't much like drums. They used tambourines a bit, but they would move these African rhythms onto other instruments. Explain that a little bit.
That's right. That's right. As Fernando Ortiz said, the good drum is played with the sticks. The bad drum is played with the hands. The hand drums were associated with Africans, with witchcraft, with people who were socially low. And the only acceptable hand drum was the tambourine or frame drum. And it was in that form that the sarabanda traveled up through Europe, not played on what Africans would call drums, but on tambourines. Along with that new instrument popular among Black Seville and Black Lisbon. Remember that at the time Columbus sailed, both Seville and Lisbon were between 5% and 10% Black. I refer to the guitar, which was an instrument that emerges in Iberia and was played by the lower social orders. The guitar was always associated with the bottom socially, and it was played by a lot of Black people in Spain who played it in a rather different way than the high style of classical guitar that we hear later. It was played in a way that was rhythmic and quite possibly more like what we hear in the cavaquinho of the samba today, a repeated rhythmic strum. This is so basic to the idea of the guitar. And Black people were playing guitar long before the guitar had six strings. At the time, it was four double strings.
Cool. And let's go ahead and hear our first song, and this will take us back. This is the world's oldest living band, the Ottoman Meter group, which is a traditional band in Turkey that tries to recreate this. I guess they've been going for several centuries, actually. They're not recreating anything. They're maintaining an old tradition. This is the Meter Assault Anthem. And that was the world's oldest living music band playing the Ottoman Meter Assault Anthem. And that's the kind of sound that terrorized Europeans fighting for Vienna in the 15th century, 16th century, 17th and 18th century.
Terrorizing podcast listeners today.
It never stops, those Turks. I also want to ask about the guitar a little bit, because they had the lute or the oud from the Muslims with the rounded back. And if you've ever played one of those like plastic Ovation guitars from the 80s with the rounded back, it's a lot louder than a normal acoustic guitar. Why did they give up a technically better piece of equipment to move to this flat-backed instrument?
After the Christians took complete control in Iberia, a campaign of demorifying the country began. Libraries were destroyed and burnt. All overt references to the previous culture were forbidden. Of course, folkways continued. The architecture was still there in many places. People in southern Spain continued taking baths the way they had done during the Islamic environment. But among the things that became uncool were the musical instruments favored by the Muslims. And that included the oud. The oud in English is called lute, and in Spanish the word is la oud, right? La oud, which becomes lute in English. But that was not really allowed. Instead, a different instrument came up that, for about 50 years or so, there's a literature, and then it kind of disappears again. And I actually learned how to play it as an undergraduate music student 50 years ago, the vihuela, or the vihuela de mano, which was a flat-backed, smaller instrument with six double pairs of strings. The oud was used to play single string melodies for the most part. It wasn't used to play the kind of counterpoint that we associate with classical guitar, where people transcribe Bach parts. That's because the oud didn't have frets, which also meant that it had all kinds of intonational subtleties. But apparently it did not begin in Spain, but the tying of frets onto the neck, which made it into a different kind of instrument. And the frets on the vihuela allowed for a different style of playing that imitated the vocal polyphony of the mass and other classical composers. So some of the first instrumental polyphony is actually for this family of plucked stringed instruments. And we start to hear for about 50 years these elaborate contrapuntal fantasies, whose scores still come down to us: Luis Milan, Luis de Narvaez, Enrique de Valderrabano, a small handful of composers who wrote some quite beautiful music that nonetheless disappeared. The vihuela was a fragile instrument, very soft, and did not really last. Instead, the guitar by the 17th century, the guitar was starting to become more popular, the so-called Baroque guitar, which we heard earlier in the Gaspar Sanz piece, which had five double strings. And then it took until the 19th century for the guitar to have six single strings.
And so there's two pieces I want to introduce while we're talking about Cuba. And I want to remind people, we discussed the Taino, the native indigenous population in Cuba, and their contribution to the music in last week. So I don't want to get into that too much. But they did have big musical rights. The population survived, although the culture was annihilated. But there's many people in Cuba still carrying the blood and genes of the native Taino. But I want to ask about two things that get involved in the picture around this time. And the first one is claves. Where does the clave come from? What was it in the ships that made it such that these manufactured worked piece of hardwood were so available in Cuba?
This is really Fernando Ortiz's hypothesis. It's quite elegant. And as far as I know, it really hasn't been refuted. Havana became a shipbuilding center for Spain. Havana still had these magnificent hardwood forests that were, of course, all cut down. And in that day, ships were not yet held together with nails, but with pegs, these hardwood pegs. And these pegs became in the, it so goes the thesis.
And what's the word for the pegs?
Thank you. Clavijas.
There
right?
you go.
Clavijas. This word clave has a whole bunch of different meanings. It's a whole complex of things. A clave can be a code. If somebody has, has a number of rings code for their telephone, like you pick up after the second ring, that's a clave, to use an actual given example. A keyboard is sometimes called a clave. Clavar can also mean to nail something in modern speech. Clave, the clavijas, apparently these became used as what we now think of as claves in the arsenal or shipyard in Havana. And this seems to have been not so much, it doesn't seem to have flourished initially among Black musicians as much as among the Spanish peasants and the people from the Canary Islands who had arrived there. And it appears that what they were doing is playing a kind of a timeline. These timelines, that is to say, they play a figure that locks down the time so that the singing poet can sing over it. This is heard in Arabic music. This is it does not appear that they originally come to Cuba from Africa, but Africans knew what to do with them. Fernando Ortiz says there's no place in Africa where claves exactly appear as they do in Cuba. And it seems that in Cuba, a purpose was found for the claves as a new Cuban music started to appear. So that I said that clave could mean several things. We've been talking about the instruments, but there is also a more theoretical sense that musicians use now when they speak of clave, which is it is a rhythmic key that underlines the way all of the rhythms of a polyrhythm are oriented. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But
let me take a whack at explaining how I understand it. So, and you can correct me where I'm wrong. So the clave keeps the master rhythm essentially for the whole polyrhythmic orchestra. Like they've got this incredible science of polyrhythm from the Congo that I think for me and you and other things is comparable to what Bach did. I mean, this is an incredible storehouse of human learning developed over centuries of how to play different beats in sync with each other. And so there's got to be one player who's got the key. And if you think about it, like you think of a key with harmonics, like as long as everybody knows what the key is, like we're in the key of G, play notes that fit in the key of G, but you can play any of the notes that fit in the key of G, right? The bass player can be playing one, the first note, the the guitar player can be playing the fifth or whatever. With the clave, as long as you're in sync with one of the beats on the clave, you could be, you know, playing three times as fast as the clave. Somebody else could be playing half as fast as the clave, but they're all keyed into the clave. Does that work?
That's pretty good. The one exception I would take to that is that I don't think that it necessarily comes from Congo. In fact, to the strongest sense of clave that I get in the extant African music of Cuba is in the Yoruba music, which was the last to be brought, which has the music of the bata has a very strong sense of clave. And I've seen in ceremonies many times a singer will mark the clave with his hands when somebody's not with it to get it right. There's a very strong sense of clave. And when I say clave, again, to build on what you just said, if you're in a band and the clave is going bop, 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 you know that you've got to play against it in a certain way. You can go bam, bam, bop, bop, bam, bop, bop, bam, but you can't go ba-ba-bam, ba-ba-ba-bam, bam, because one way is with the clave, the other way is against, and you'll get, and the dancers will stop. You'll be fired. You'll be thrown out the window. You'll be ostracized and shunned if you don't know how to keep your rhythm in line with the clave, even though you are playing your own independent rhythm. And it makes it possible to stack a polyrhythm. It should be noted that this is really not what we have in music in the United States. While we may have this undulating sense of bump, 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 take, for example, the Bo Diddley beat, bump, dump, 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 bump. It's not necessarily being used to stack a polyrhythm. It's a different kind of texture. In music in the United States, we tend to have more of a beat. I argue that Cuban music has less of a beat and more of a polyrhythm.
Awesome. And let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you more about these guitar playing singing poets.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Well, we talked about this a little bit and how it relates to the modern, you know, Mexican corrido. But you say in here, the Cuban guajiro is not a musician, but rather a poet. Explain what this whole tradition that evolved of poets playing guitars and singing these improvised but formulaic patterns that has obviously got immense potential.
This poetry of the Spanish language, we talked last time about Elio Antonio de Nebrija and his standardization of Castilian grammar just in time to build a hemisphere-wide empire that all spoke the same standardized modern European language. This language being disseminated all around the hemisphere meant that all up and down the hemisphere, there were people singing, speaking, improvising, and reciting poetry in Castilian, with, you know, the local dialect variant, certainly. But the sense of this, to me, is that most people were illiterate, okay? And but that doesn't mean that there wasn't a strongly cultivated tradition of oral poetry, which in some cases entailed recitation of written poetry that had been memorized orally. And this gave rise, of course, also to poetic controversy, what they call in the decima controversia, where people argue in verse according to, as you said, predetermined rhyme schema, most famously the decima espinela, the 10-line stanza, which has for us perhaps the peculiar rhyme scheme of A, B, B, A, A, C, C, D, D, C, which is kind of a, you kind of have to grow up in that system to really be able to improvise it fluidly, but it's amazing the way that someone well-versed in decimas can improvise an argument in that octosyllabic 10-line form.
And it really plays off of the strengths of Spanish as a rhyming language. It's an incredibly easy language to rhyme in. So if you're ingrained with that complicated rhyme scheme in your head, you can really go to town. And people have been doing it for centuries now.
Yeah. And in between, when we say poet rather than musician, there's not a lot of musical variety in these. You can, if you're in Cuba, you can see every Sunday night on the longest running show on Cuban TV, Palmas y Caña, Palms and Cane, people arguing and having controversias in decimas. And in between the rhymed parts, there will be an instrumental interlude where the laúd, the country laúd, the country form of the lute, will or another instrument will play a formulaic interlude, which doesn't vary a lot, but this gives the singer a moment to catch his or her mental breath, so to speak, to come up with what they're going to say as soon as the interlude is over. So it's almost more of like the hold music on a quiz show or something.
Yeah. And let's go ahead and hear a little bit. This is Josito Fernandez doing the Guajira Guantanamera.
Más que el mar, denle al vano el oro tierno que arde y brilla en el cristal. A mí denme el bosque eterno cuando rompen el sol.
right, and that was Josito Fernandez doing the Guajiro Guantanamera. As always, apologies for my terrible, abysmal Spanish. There's no excuse for my pronunciation.
We're going to send you to school, Nate. You're going to be good this next year.
My brother got sent.
Can I just say something about the Guajira Guantanamera? Everybody knows that song, of course, because in the 1960s and not before then, partly through the efforts of Pete Seeger, it kind of became the Cuban anthem worldwide. But when Joséito Fernández composed it in 1928, it had a rather different function, which is, Joséito Fernández was a radio troubadour. In the 30s, there were a lot, during the Depression, there were lots of radio stations in Havana that, and they had live entertainment all day long. They didn't play records. And the cheapest thing to put on the air was a troubadour. This was the so-called intermediate trova, between the old trova, the vieja trova, and the nueva trova. And these guys would come on air and sing decimas and songs and play their guitar, and they cost almost nothing. Well, what Joséito Fernández would do was actually sing the news in decima form. If they're in particular, the sensationalist news, the kind of stuff you would see, you know, the New York Daily News headlines kind of news, you know, bus accident kills 10, and he would make up a decima about the bus accident and how sad it was. And so there actually came to be a saying in Cuba, when somebody dies, they say they sang him the Guantanamera.
Well, hopefully nobody will be singing it for us.
And in between each verse of his of the news, he would sing Guantanamera, Guajira Guantanamera, which he could do on autopilot while giving him a chance to compose the next stroke.
Man, all right. So now we got to introduce a new culture into the story, and these guys kind of come out as the villains, or the most villainous of many villains. Well, we could argue about that, but they're definitely up there as in terms of heinous. How do the French get involved? How do they carve off half of Espanola and make it what we now know as Haiti, but was not known as Haiti until the Haitian Revolution? How do they get in there, and what was their impact on the music?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the last Habsburg king of Spain, Charles II, who was the result of a long line of inbreeding and was
everyone should Google Habsburg jaw. Google Habsburg jaw, and you'll see what happens when you marry your cousin.
Yeah, Google Habsburg jaw. He didn't really have all the cheese on his enchilada, and there was a problem in Hispaniola, La Hispaniola, the island that today houses the Dominican Republic and Haiti, which was that other nations were breaking Spain's trade monopoly by sending their merchant ships to trade with the settlers, the Spanish settlers on the north coast of the island. And they were bringing worse. They were bringing Lutheran Bibles, the heresy of Protestantism. And the king ordered settlement of the island be shrunk down to Santo Domingo in the south. And he even hung recalcitrant farmers who refused to relocate. So he depopulated the island, which was about the stupidest thing you could do. Santo Domingo was reinforced, but the rest of the island was empty, and it became a void into which first freelance cow killers who survived hunting the wild cattle that had proliferated after the Spanish arrived. These people were called bucaneers in an almost entirely male society. They were replaced. They gave rise to, they gave way to pirates over time, headquartered especially on the island of Tortuga. And finally, the French moved in. And by the time the 18th century was well underway, the French were starting to establish plantations there. And after as the 18th century rolled on, the western side of the island, which they called Saint-Domingue, became the richest piece of ground in the world, with the largest number of Africans ever assembled in one place to work in labor camps, of course, as was done in plantations, in a spectacularly productive industrially and cruel humanly environment. So the Haitian Revolution, which happened...
Well, before we get there, speaking of the cruel environment, because there's a very famous French aristocrat, the Marquis de Sade, whose writings, you know, just the dude loved sadism, and it's powerful, horrific stuff if you've ever read it. These people were living the Marquis de Sade, right?
These people were living it. Colin Diane, who at the time was writing under the name Joan Diane, used the phrase "living model," that is to say, the fantasies of the Marquis de Sade had their living model in the plantations of Saint-Domingue.
So yeah, so that's what we're dealing with here, and this system was, there was no way this was going to last, because the slavers who were indulging in this kind of decadence and cruelty, and I mean, they were living large, there were opera companies and lavish mansions, and they're outnumbered, what, hundreds to one? Thousands
there were
to one?
At the time of the uprising in 1791, there were about 30,000 whites and roughly an equal number of free people of color, and 500,000 enslaved people, two-thirds of whom had been born in Africa. So they were hugely outnumbered.
And when this uprising happens, and it's an incredible story, maybe we'll get to it at some point and let it roll, it flings people, there's this diaspora out of this former French colony. Some of them land in Cuba. Where do they land, and what's their impact?
The Haitian diaspora, the diaspora of people escaping, especially, there were several waves of fleeing the revolution in Saint-Domingue, because the revolution in Saint-Domingue was really a long, complicated process, that at one point it was a six-sided war. It was largely settled by 1795 with Toussaint Louverture in charge, but then Napoleon reinvaded in 1802 with the largest army that had yet crossed the Atlantic, all of which is to say that it was, you could almost think of it as multiple struggles, which we refer to collectively as the Haitian Revolution. And so this generated various waves of emigration, of refugees fleeing there. But the big one was in the 1802. And at that point, it looks now like the most recent numbers I've heard based on more recent scholarship suggest that maybe 15,000 people wound up in eastern Cuba, in Oriente, especially in the city of Santiago, which was had a mere 10,000 people before this movement took place, in Baracoa.
What was the
and
ethnic?
In the hillside, in the mountains, where they brought the cultivation of coffee to Cuba. Sorry, what were you going to say?
What was the ethnic makeup? Like, you've got masters and enslaved people, right?
Well, we don't have. I don't know of a really good census. It happened rather chaotically, and I don't know of a good census of who was who. We have a better sense of when a subsequent movement in 1809 caused a number of those of the French speakers in Oriente to leave and go to Louisiana. We have a much better sense of who they were, but they were white slave owners. Many of them were women escaping without the men. Plantation owners escaped. They, in some cases, they were able to bring their enslaved property, human property, with them. Although, since slavery had ended with the Haitian Revolution, they were They were in some cases re-enslaved people. It's hard to know exactly what the breakdown was, but we do know that all of the social groups, one way or another, arrived in eastern Cuba.
All right, and let's hear our last song, and this is the Contradanza from the Cuban zarzuela Cecilia Valdez by Gonzalo Roy. And that was the Contradanza from the Cuban zarzuela Cecilia Valdez by Gonzalo Roy, conducted by Andres Trujillo, and the Habanera Dance Ensemble. So tell us about this Contradanza. What is it, and why was it a big deal? How did it travel around?
The Contradanza, or Contradanza in Spanish, was a style of dance more than it was a single genre of music. But it was a style of dance that was danced all over, from as far east as Russia and as far west as New Orleans, all through Europe, and in the Spanish possessions in the Americas, as well as the French possessions in the Americas. And it was a line dance. It was a dance of figures, a cousin to the American square dance, where people make figures and others follow them. There was in the Americas, the Contradanza acquired a new character, which was a caller who called the figures. This was considered to be a barbarian thing by Europeans, and it may well have been a Black innovation in the Americas, to actually call out the figures as if one were in a dance class. The Contradanza, with time, morphed into the danza, which became very popular in Puerto Rico, and ultimately the danzón. All of this is one thread of dance. And the music of the Contradanza was the social music of the first half of the 19th century in Cuba. And this famous set piece in the novel Cecilia Valdez, from which Gonzalo Roig's opera was taken, was set in, I believe, the 1830s. And it was set at a dance where people were dancing Contradanza. In one of those dances in which women of mixed race, in quotes, could meet white men for dancing purposes and assignations.
Yeah, and one thing that I'm still struggling to grasp, because I haven't done my homework on the European dance history, but my understanding is that this was a really big deal, very saucy, because you're dancing like in a square dance where it's, a group of, say, four couples dancing together. But that's a big deal. The waltz doesn't come along until the 1840s, and it's scandalous. Right. Boy, is it going to scandalize Europe. And so getting to be holding, having your arm wrapped around the waist of your partner, even though you're in a group of eight, that's pretty saucy, because, we're coming from this staid European tradition of line dancing, where you've got groups entirely separated. Is this remotely right?
Dancing in embracing pairs was, yes, indeed. It was it was risque. And it may be that that's what propelled the Contradanza into becoming the danza, was that the danza, precisely in the danza, there were embracing couples.
All right. And now we're going to introduce one more player. And you were totally right. No way are we going to cover 19th century. I'll have to drag you back to talk about 19th century Cuba next time. But another player comes into the picture, the British, who briefly rule Cuba. What's their impact?
The British impact is enormous. In 1762, the British take Havana as part of the what was known retroactively as the Seven Years' War, the same conflict that in the United States or its colonial predecessor was known as the French and Indian War. And the British moved into Havana, took it over, didn't really even bother to take Matanzas, but they ramped up Cuba's sleepy sugar industry, removed the regulations on importing enslaved Africans. So they started to bring in slaves in some numbers, and they jacked up the production of sugar. This started to make Cuba a sugar power, which after the Haitian Revolution would be consolidated. It also had the effect of enhancing greatly the power of the Creole class of Cuba. That is to say, the Creole planters who got a taste for independence with this new commercial empowerment that they received under the British.
And what did the production of sugar require them to import in massive numbers?
Because sugar, as grown at the time, and really always, is a labor-intensive crop that require that the profitability was directly proportional to how much labor you could apply to the land. And the calculus was a very cruel one. It was, in fact, the introduction of capitalism to Cuba, the notion that it was cheaper to work X number of workers 20 hours a day in the season. Sugar work is highly seasonable. Work them to death and replace them after a few years with fresh arrivals from Africa than to have, say, twice as many workers and have them work 10 hours a day and have to feed them all year long when there was nothing for them to do. So sugar was a cruel and deadly crop. Most of the Africans who were brought to the Americas were brought to work sugar. Only in the United States, with the exception of Louisiana, where there was a sugar crop after 1795, but only in the United States was there not sugar. And slavery developed in a very different way in the United States than it did in all of the sugar-producing territories, which reached from Cuba down to Brazil.
And in the satanic terms of slavery, I guess you could say that Northern American slave owners, slavers, had more of an ownership model of the slave, where they looked to profit off the slave for the lifetime of the enslaved person's productivity and breed their children like cattle. This is the more I learn about this sense of just more sickening it gets, an impossibly evil system. But in Cuba, they had more of a rental car model where you just drive it into the ground and get a new one. And that caused wave after wave of new immigration to happen from Africa. And next time we'll talk about how those communities who could keep their culture, unlike in North America, where the enslaved people were brutally separated from their neighbors and co-tribe, co-language speakers. In Cuba, you could get with people from your tribe, people from your area, and even congregate on rare time off and play music together. So we'll talk about that next time, as well as the most popular and probably greatest American musician of the 19th century, although he's so obscure, I'm not even going to mention his name. I'm going to tease you. But this dude was from New Orleans, Jewish cat from New Orleans, who spends a lot of time in Paris and a lot of time in Havana. And he but follows the lead of, and how do I say Berlioz, the French composer with the giant orchestras, B-E-L-I-O-Z?
Berlioz.
Okay, so this guy's going to imitate the monster orchestras of Berlioz and put on these massive performances in Havana, the likes of which never heard again. So, well, thank you so much, Ned. The book is Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. And we'll be back next time on Latin Roll.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Norman LeBrecht to discuss his book, Why Beethoven? Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.